Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Adisk. Well, let me change that around. It isn't a typical Friday. It's going into the holiday weekend. So my co-host, Alfred Adisk, will be joining James Corbett of the Corbett Report here right after the first segment of today's program. Old habits are hard to break sometimes. So let's get started anyway with the market report for Friday, September 2nd, 2016. And once again, you're listening to Financial Survival, and I'm Melody Cedarstrom. I was just looking outside for the clouds of the hurricane or the tropical storm Hermine. You say tomato, I say tomato. As she's approaching the northeast, and the clouds were getting a little thick out there, and I thought, well, maybe it is arriving a little bit sooner than they had expected, but that doesn't have anything to do with the program today. So for all of you who will be in the path of the tropical storm, be safe out there. You don't take any chances. Gold today, of course, U.S. payrolls grew, but at a slower pace. And with that, we had a little bit of a stronger gold price today, up $990 at $1,324. And with the slower pace in the payrolls, it deems that she won't raise rates. So therefore, gold went up. Even if she does raise rates, gold is going to go up. She raised rates in December, and we've had a high increase of gold of, what, 30% at one point in time. We're currently at, what, 26%? So, hey, raise the rates. Let's get another 30% out of gold before the year end. Silver was up 49 cents at $19.44. Platinum was up $14 at $1,064. Palladium was up 8 at $677. The USDX today was a little bit strong, 0.22 at 95.85. Crude oil was up 1 at 111. No one's working today. Everything closed early. Markets were open, but only those in the lower rung worked today. And here I am working. We had a busy morning this morning, and got a little quiet here in this afternoon, and I will be closing when I do finish this 20-minute live broadcast. Let's go ahead and look at what the paper markets are doing today. They were up also higher. The Dow was up, was all ready for you guys. The Dow was up 72 points at 18,491. The NASDAQ was up 22 points at 5249. The S&P was up 9 at 2179. The Euro was 112. And I don't know why. I guess when they think no one's watching, they just move things around. There wasn't a lot of movement in the 10-year yield. If I see that number cross my computer screen here in a little bit, I will update you on that. But let's get moving. I got a lot of things I want to talk to you about, and I only have a short 10 or so minutes. First of all is the U.S. payrolls. Of course, you all probably know by now the payrolls climbed by 151,000. Last month, it was following a 275,000 gain in July, and that one was certainly larger than estimated. And, of course, August was certainly not expected either at 151,000. Everyone was looking for 180,000. And you're going to see numbers, good numbers throughout the election cycle here. And I also have the moderators for the debates. And, you're going to have to love Donald Trump because he's going to hammer them. He's going to hammer that media pretty hard when I tell you which ones they have chosen. I thank everybody. But we'll talk about it. Let me finish this up first. So we have 180,000 for the Bloomberg was expecting. So that was a little bit low at 151,000. The August figure was consistent with the payroll growth so far this year. What's funny, they talk about the world's largest economy as it slogs through a period of weak investment, and some companies have difficulty finding workers. Well, what companies? Which workers? What are the ones that they can't? Are they rocket scientists? I mean, where can't they find workers is what I want to know. But they won't tell you that. It's just, oh, some companies have problems finding workers. The economy is good and great, but can't find a qualified worker. The government's unemployment rate held about 9.7% as the number of people working part-time for economic reasons rose slightly. Of course, you're not going to hear a lot of talk about that. Some 6.05 million American employees were in part-time jobs, but they want to work full-time. That is up from 5.94 million in the prior month. That's a pretty big pop. So I'm really glad that the economy is so good that it can at least supply part-time jobs for people so they can work two and three jobs in order to sustain their standard of living. Hourly earnings, that rose 0.1% from a month earlier. The year-over-year increase was 2.4%. The average work week, that dropped by 6 minutes. So it doesn't seem to be a lot of people working overtime if you're the workers, the hours that you work has dropped by 6 minutes to 30.3 hours in July. And this is the lowest since 2014 and the first drop in 6 months. Yesterday, manufacturing was cut back. Factories cut payrolls by 14,000, and that is the most in 3 months. Employment at construction companies fell for the fourth time in the last 5 months. Employment slowed at private service providers with payrolls in professional and business services. And, of course, that is posting the smallest gains the smallest decrease since July. Retail jobs rose by 15.1. That's 15,100. Jack Ma, I think everybody pretty much knows who he is. He's the executive chairman of Alibaba. He shouldn't be buying property in this country and enjoying this country when he talks about globalization. And he just wants it to grow. But he thinks that if globalization, when trade stops, wars can follow. Now, I do believe that, and that is important. But, there's something free trade, bad. Fair trade, good. And it's time we get some fair trade into this country. I think we're too far gone not to have globalization. But he talks about the mall and pop shops for e-commerce that is being penalized because of all this anti-globalization talk and the fear of, particularly here in the States, and also the Brexit. And he thinks it should grow. He thinks that you should pretty much eliminate any tariffs, inspections, and any other type of red tape that can stop any type of shop from selling online. And that's how he thinks the young people will be able to provide for themselves for the rest of their lives. He says that we need solutions for young people to leverage the technology we have so they can buy anywhere and sell anywhere and trade anywhere. So, I do believe this is, do I like it? No, I don't. But let's get some fair trade into this country and make sure you get out and vote this year. I mentioned we had the moderators were announced yesterday. Matt Lauer, I guess he'll be moderating the first presidential that was released yesterday. And of course, Lauer is a past member. He was a past member on the Clinton Global Initiative's website, along with Anderson Cooper and Katie Couric. So all the moderators for all of this fall's debates were released today. The lineup, it's just typical. You have NBC's Lester Holt, ABC's Martha Raddatz, CNN's Anderson Cooper, Fox News' Chris Wallace, and CBS' Elaine Wahano will moderate the presidential and vice presidential debates this fall. Of course, this was announced today by the Commission on Presidential Debates. Holt, he anchors NBC's Nightly News, will moderate the first debate at Hofstra University in New York on September 26th. It will be a traditional debate divided into six segments of 15 minutes each on major topics to be determined by Holt. Wahano, she's an anchor on CBS live streaming service, CBSN. She moderates the vice presidential debate on October 4th at Longwood University in Virginia, which will be a traditional debate as well, divided into nine timed segments of 10 minutes each. Then you're going to have some town meeting debates, that type of a style, with Anderson Cooper and the ABC's chief global correspondent and co-anchor of this week, Raddatz. Wallace, he's the host of Fox News Sunday. He will become the first Fox News host to moderate a general election debate since the network's founding, and he's going to host the final presidential debate on October 19th at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and the same format will apply as the first one. So again, most of these are very liberal, very pro-Clinton, and luckily, I believe that Mr. Trump has no problem. And he's not afraid to call out the media, and I think the debates will be very interesting, to say the least. So I know I'll watch the first one. I'll probably watch the VP, and then we'll have to see how Mr. Trump handles himself. And another report out today: we have retailers are beginning to scramble. There's a we talk about the ships that have that carry the giant containers across from Asia to our ports to drop off product. Well, we have some retailers that are scrambling, as one of those shippers went into bankruptcy. We have some of these retailers are scrambling to work out some of these contingency plans, because a lot of this is holiday merchandise. a lot of these stores, you know, they get their merchandise for the holidays, you know, so this might have some of the products in there. But giant container ships from the South Korean-based Hanjin shipping lines are marooned with their cargo of what experts say are lots of TVs and printers, but also loads of home furnishings and clothing. Hanjin, the world's seventh largest container shipper, they filed for bankruptcy on Wednesday, and they stopped accepting new cargo. With its assets being frozen, ships from China to Canada were refused permission to offload or to take aboard containers because there were no guarantees that the tugboat pilots would be paid. So it's also been a factor in shipping rates rising and could hurt some trucking firms with contracts to pick up goods from these ships. So since they, you know, filed bankruptcy, your shipping rates are rising. The South Korean giant, it represents only about 8% of the trans-Pacific trade volume for the U.S. market. While some retailers may already have, again, some merchandise for the holiday season, some still say they might be affected. October is a very critical month. Retailers always have robust contingency plans. Let's see, JCPenney is Hanjin's. Uses Hanjin, is one of the several ocean freight carriers that it uses. And when it learned that there might be an issue, it began to divert and reroute its containers. It says it uses a variety of transportation methods and ports. And right now, it does not expect a significant effect on the flow of merchandise. You have Best Buy. You have companies like Walmart, Target. They're all waiting for details about the proceedings and the implications to its merchandise. Yeah, these ships are just out, and they're just sitting out there floating around. I'm not even sure they're anchored. As of Friday, 27 ships had been refused entry to ports or terminals. Well, they left there, they're empty. You know, people just left them. They vacated these ships. The Seoul-based company said one ship in Singapore had been seized by the ship's owner. The ports of L.A. and Long Beach, which is these are the nation's busiest port complex, three of their container ships, ranging from about 700 feet to 1,100 feet long, were drifting offshore, or they were anchored away from the terminals as of yesterday. There's a fourth vessel that was supposed to leave Long Beach on Thursday, but it remained anchored inside the breakwater. So, hey, the company says we're bankrupt. We can't pay any bills. So don't bother asking us for any money. It's going to be the U.S. government pretty soon. So you have cargo that is headed to and from Asia that's just in limbo. You have these merchants that are looking to stock shelves. So we don't know how long this is going to go on. You know, so if you're looking for something in particular for the holidays, you better check to make sure that you can get it. October is usually the busiest month for cargo from South Korea to the U.S., accounting for about 11.5% of the annual total. I did see some numbers as far as the shipping rates, but I can't locate that. Global demand and trade have suffered since the 2008 recession. We talk about the Baltic Dry Index. We talked about the shipping rates. But these steamship lines just continue to build more and larger vessels. So the weaker trade, overcapacity, have sent the ocean shipping rates plunging in recent years. Get this, some of these rates, these prices to ship, they were as low as $600 per container. And they say that wouldn't even cover fuel costs for the huge ships. So, again, another indication that things are not going very well, either here in the U.S. or around the world. Everything is impacted. Everything is connected because you can welcome that to the globalization. 1-800-375-4188. Monday we will be closed for the holiday. The Labor Day holiday. Please be safe. Enjoy your families this weekend. We will be back with a full program on Tuesday. Our offices will be open on Tuesday at 9 a.m. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. And Al and James Corbett will be joining you right after this short break.
Condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit, toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett. James has been working in Japan since 2004, started the Corbett Report, that's C-O-R-B-E-T-T, the CorbettReport.com website, 2007, as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also editorial writer for the International Forecaster, a weekly news letter. He's Canadian by birth, and he's one of the most articulate, intelligent, knowledgeable people that you're ever likely to run into. Hello, James. How are you doing?
It's embarrassing me. I can't. How am I going to live up to that?
Well, I don't know. You can. I'm sure you have some people who can help you if you can't live up to it yourself. But the truth of it, that is the truth.
Well, there you go. I'll quote some Shakespeare for you.
It's not hard. You really have a fantastic amount of knowledge available. It's been one of a kind of a running gag now for me, at least for 2 years, trying to find a question that I can pose that you can't answer. And we've done it on at least one, maybe one and a half attempts out of 2 years. Fantastic amount of knowledge available essentially at your fingertips. Not many people are as articulate as you. Your intellect is, I'd bet that your IQ is at least 105 points. I don't know if that's true or false, but I'll bet it's at least 105, and maybe even 110. Any truth to that?
I actually truly don't know. I've never had an IQ really? Test, and I don't plan on it. I don't put a lot of stock in that number as something inherently meaningful. Because there are different types of intelligences, and that really just measures a certain test-taking type of intelligence that may or may not be useful in the real world.
I had a high IQ test once upon a time. Well, actually, I was a National Merit Scholar is what it was. It wasn't an IQ test per se, but it was National Merit Scholar. And I used to wonder if the reason I had a high test score was because I cheated on the test. All right? And the way I cheated, the person who conducted the test, there were 50, 100, 200 people in the room. I have no idea. I don't recall anymore taking that test when I think I was a junior in high school. Maybe even a sophomore. I don't recall clearly. But they said, we're going to have an hour to deal with mathematics. And it doesn't matter how many questions you answer. What counts is, how many did you get right? I thought about that, and I said, that's nonsense, because what that means, if I can answer one question out of the 100 or however many they had in the file, if I answer just one of those questions correctly, ta-da, I get a perfect score. I knew that couldn't be right. Right? So I deduced that, you got to run this thing is about speed, get in there and get it done in a hurry. And I wondered for years if I had a high score because I had essentially ignored the instructions, or did I have a high score because I was smart enough to ignore the instructions? And I never did an answer for that. Blah, blah, blah. Very stressful. Here's something that I think you should have seen. I'm sure you've seen this. And whether this is true or false, you can be. I'm operating on the assumption that this report is true. This is from International Clearinghouse. And it says, the broken chessboard. Brzezinski gives up on empire. You know what I'm talking about?
I did actually read a little bit of an article about this, but perhaps you can just flesh it out for the audience.
Well, we've got much of the article here in front of me. Zygmunt Brzezinski, the main architect of Washington's plan to rule the world, has abandoned the scheme and called for the forging of ties with Russia and China. Zygmunt Brzezinski's article in the American Interest. Titled Towards a Global Realignment, has been largely ignored by the media. It shows that powerful members of the policymaking establishment no longer believe that Washington will prevail in its quest to extend U.S. hegemony across the Middle East and Asia. Brzezinski, who was the main proponent of the idea and who drew up the blueprint for imperial expansion in his 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives, has done an about-face and called for a dramatic revision of the strategy. Now, they have some more. They have some excerpts here and whatever. And does this sound credible to you? Do you think this is a legitimate story?
There are elements to it, but I'm not sure that this is the right framing of what is happening here. So let's actually go to the source rather than talking about the article. Let's look at Brzezinski's actual article, which was published in the American Interest. It's called Toward a Global Realignment. Yep. And he's talking about the different verities regarding the emerging redistribution of global political power. And he talks about some of these verities, like the United States is the world's politically, economically, military most powerful entity. Russia is experiencing the latest convulsive phase of its imperial devolution. China is rising steadily. Europe is not now and not likely to become a global power. And the violent political awakening among post-colonial Muslims is in part a belated reaction to their occasionally brutal suppression, mostly by European powers. But what does he take out of this? He says, taken together as a unified framework, these five verities tell us that the United States must take the lead in realigning the global power architecture in such a way that the violence erupting within and occasionally projected beyond the Muslim world, and in the future possibly from other parts of what used to be called the Third World, can be contained without destroying the global order. we can sketch this new architecture by elaborating briefly each of the five foregoing verities. So that's the basis that he's working from. And I'm not sure this is a particularly stunning about face for Brzezinski so much as an incorporation of some of the on the ground political realities that exist at the moment that may not have been quite as prominent 2 decades ago at the end of the Cold War, where he was writing about the grand chessboard and all of that. In the end, I think ultimately what he wants is essentially the same, a global geopolitical power architecture that is, we're at least going to be led into that by the United States. And I mean, it might not necessarily mean that at the end of the day, it is the United States per se that is running the whole show exactly, but I would imagine it is still the same technocrats that he has always wanted to have power over the global system, But that the composition of that technocratic class may be a little bit more multicultural, shall we say, rather than simply just being the United States. But I, again, I'm not sure that this is fundamentally different. Ideologically, what he's talking about is the same thing. He still wants the global architectural framework for a global order, a new world order, if you will.
I agree with you. I think that's exactly that's the way I read this also. It seems to me that the world has given Brzezinski some lemons, and now he's trying to make lemonade. And he says the United States needs to take the lead in realigning the global power architecture. If we're going to realign it, that implies something's been lost. Power that used to enforce a certain alignment has dissipated. There's a problem with how much power does the United States have, and can they take the lead? Have we alienated so many people around the globe that we're not going to get a leadership position? Is that not, or are we more likely to devolve into 3 or 4 blocks rather than one single cohesive entity?
Right. I think that to a certain extent, the power structure is working out the best way to preserve the power structure. And we are watching that happen. And if the way to maintain the power structure and the oligarchical elite is for them to have competing power blocks, or at least what appear to be competing power blocks that are all working within the same global system. I mean, you can have different players on the chessboard that are that have different that have their piece of the chessboard, which they rule in maybe slightly different ways. But ultimately, if they're all playing the same game by the same rules, then it doesn't really matter on the big scheme of things from that perspective. If your ideology is we must have this global system. And yeah, you can have different flavors within that global system, but it's all going to be, sold from the same shop. So it's the Baskin-Robbins version of global geopolitics rather than some sort of monolithic order, that may not be sustainable. The idea of a one government with one system that rules over everyone equally, maybe humanity is just not cut out for that, or maybe, people will always revolt against that type of centralized power structure. So just make it look a little bit more decentralized. And I think that's probably the approach from which Brzezinski and other geopolitical, real politic realists, so-called, work from. They are just looking for the best way to make this happen. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to, stick religiously to one script. They're just going to find out what's the best way to make it happen in the way that they want it.
You mentioned that all of these, if there's a breakdown into regions, for example, rather than to a one-world government, but it won't matter much so long as they're all part of the same global system. Can you give folks an idea of what you think are the essential elements of that single global system?
I would say that a major part of it has to, the backbone really of this has to be the monetary order.
I agree with
and
you.
That has to be on the back of the prevailing paradigm of a central bank that manages money for different nations, or it could be a regional central bank like we see in the ECB, or it could be some other type of entity that's emerging now from the shadows. So some sort of post World Bank, post Bretton Woods type era institution that may serve that function. But fundamentally, I think it has to be based on that, because that is the one thing that creates the power, the centralization of power is encapsulated and perhaps enabled by the control of the monetary system. So as long as the monetary system is ordered that way, which is why I think it has been oft pointed out, I think usually erroneously, that, you know, the axis of evil are the only three nations that don't have a Rothschild-controlled central bank is usually the way that's framed. I don't think that's technically accurate, but it does encapsulate, I think, something real in that Iran, North Korea, these types of countries that are clearly holdouts from that central bank type system and the usury that it's based on tend to be the ones in the crosshairs of all sides, and tend to be the ones that get eliminated from the face of the planet. So I think that the monetary order is fundamental to this. And based on top of that, there are going to be international structures for dealing with international disputes and things. And again, the interregional, there may be actual real interregional conflict and jockeying for position. But again, as long as everyone's playing by the rules, generally speaking, well, you must have a central bank that's administering in this way, and you must play nice with these international organizations, then there's room for that type of jockeying for position.
I saw an article recently that predicted that we're coming to a serious financial problem, of course, and that's hardly news, but they saw it breaking down three different possible solutions. One, government would manage to create enough inflation for our fiat currency, where the fiat currency would help to destroy the debt and somehow everyone would live happily ever after. And two, the world governments would rely on special drawing rights from the IMF. And three, they'd go back to a gold-based monetary system, which is the last thing in the world that they want to do, or they might have to do it. But that was their third choice. My question is this. The idea that special drawing rights can be used to back the dollar and the euro and whatever other fiat currencies are around and exist in the world right now, is that really a credible plan? And the reason I ask that, aren't we just saying we'll take a fiat special drawing right to back a fiat dollar or fiat euro? Do we have anything tangible? Are special drawing rights really tangible, or are they just essentially another fiat currency?
They're essentially a second-order currency. They're not even a currency per se. They certainly can't be used by you or I. They're only exchangeable at the central bank level, and they are based on other fiat currencies. But I think the logic would be, and I suppose it is at least consistent logic, that, well, the current monetary order, we have this U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency, but that itself is backed up by nothing. Of course, it was detached from gold in the 70s. It's truly nothing other than faith in the U.S. government. Well, that's an inherently unstable system. What if something happened to the U.S. government? What if people stop believing in the U.S. government? So instead of that, why don't we have five different currencies that are based in different regions with different systems and different governments? And then it's inherently more stable, because one of those falls, well, that's not such a big problem. If all five of them fall, well, you've probably got a global situation on your hands anyway. So it's at least a more stable way of making a fiat-based system. But more stable doesn't necessarily mean much in the long run, because, as we know, all fiat currencies eventually go to their real value, which is zero. And it's really just a matter of time on that. So it's a way of holding off the inevitable. It's a way of making a more explicitly multipolar world. There are obviously, within the globalist ideology, there are reasons why you would want such a system. But if you do not adhere to the globalist ideology, if you do not believe in the fiat currencies in the first place, then obviously it's just exchanging, you know, one fig leaf for five fig leaves, which is hardly, you know, the ultimate solution here.
You know, you made the comment that the fiat currency depends on people's confidence in the government. And I think actually it depends their confidence in other people. And what I mean by that is this. By law, the government doesn't have to redeem its fiat currency. You can take a $100 bill into the Federal Reserve and they'll give you a new $100 bill, but that's all you'll ever get. You're not going to get anything tangible from the government and or the Federal Reserve for fiat currency. If you want fiat currency to work, what it's based on is, if I'm dumb enough to take a $100 bill, piece of paper, as payment for my labor, the reason I do is not because I trust the government. but because I know there are other morons in this country that are even dumber than I am, that I can give that $100 bill to John Smith guy who lives down the street and he's a grocery store. He operates a grocery store. I'll be able to get some food out of John. All right? He will give me tangible. The government doesn't redeem the dollar. Your fellow man redeems the dollar, and that's a fascinating possibility because it means government doesn't have to pay its bills. They just issue these pieces of paper, and they let you redeem it, not with the government, but with your neighbors. And so we are the ones who really put the backbone behind the currency. We'll take a break for some commercials, and when we come back, we'll get your take on whether or not that's a valid take. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. We'll be back in a moment with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Please stay tuned.
Obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at the 3Ws dot thepowerherbs.com.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
I'm Alfred Addis, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from CorbettReport.com. And when we left for our last bunch of commercials, I raised the idea that government doesn't really redeem its currency. And therefore, we don't have confidence in government, really. We have confidence in the guy across the street who will accept that $100 bill. Pay for or groceries or tools or services, mowing the lawn or whatever, but it's our neighbors. You and I are the ones that make, that give the fiat currency its value. Does that strike you as a credible idea, or do you think it's wrong?
I think it is 100% right. It touches on the real fundamental nature of what money is and what function it actually serves, which is essentially, it is a proof to the community that you have done something productive that has earned you this, whatever it is, this paper or whatever is serving as the money, that shows that you are a productive member of society. So I, you know, I'll trade with you and then I'll get this and I'll trade that with someone else. That is the function it serves. It is fundamentally, it is about people interacting with each other. It's about the what we create in the world. And on top of that, you have had the government and, of course, the banks perch themselves as the monopolistic controllers of these tokens, which gives them incredible power. But again, that power comes from the people actually engaging in commerce with each other, creating things for each other. That's where that power of that money comes from. But the government usurps that power and takes it for itself, and obviously the banksters that that control the government. So that, I mean, that's the most important part to keep in mind when we're considering this and the way that the system has been structured and the way we've been taught to think that money is some sort of special substance that has to be specially created and controlled, created by the banks and controlled by the government. Otherwise, you know, where would we be? Instead of realizing that it really is, in many ways, the literal instantiation of our blood, our sweat, our tears, that we make this money valuable and that the government just sits on top of it and sucks that value up.
You know, historically, the government, when it issued a note, it issued a silver certificate, it issued a gold certificate, and for the most part, government, you could accept that piece of paper, but you could also take it down to a bank or to United States Treasury. You could say, listen, I don't want this $100 bill. I would rather have 100 silver dollars. They'd give you 100 silver dollars. It was redeemable by the government. The people that wrote that dollar bill, they actually would redeem it with gold or silver. But today, that they don't redeem those notes. They are redeemed by your neighbors. And the point is, the government doesn't really have to pay its bills. All the government has to do is create another bond, issue another $1 trillion in these Federal Reserve notes, and they can go out and spend them, because I will accept them because I know I can pass one off with you, and you'll take them because you can use them someplace else, and so on. But the government isn't really paying its bills, and it's no wonder that government becomes enormous. If I didn't have to pay my bills, how much could I own? I could own the state of Texas, you know, in short order if I didn't have to pay my bills. Here, let me give you a check. How many zeros do you want? You see my point?
Right. No, of course. And to bring this home to people, it might sound like airy kind of, you know, theoretical mumbo jumbo in monetary and systems and economics, but there are real world ramifications for all of this. And it's no coincidence that it was largely the expenditures on the Vietnam War that started causing a lot of central banks around the world to get nervous about their dollar holdings and start asking for gold, which prompted Nixon to take the dollar off the gold standard, which, if you look at the chart, you know, look at U.S. debt over time and look from the 70s onward, and it just explodes from that point because, of course, yeah, they dehinge it from anything. There's absolutely nothing tying it down, so they just print as much as they possibly can. And what does that fuel? That fuels the expansion of the American military empire. And so it's no surprise. You have war after war after war after war, and all of this, you know, threats of war, and, oh, we need a new $30 billion, $1 trillion, $1 quadrillion, you know, F-79 fighter, or whatever the next boondoggle coming along because of the threats and that they themselves are creating. All of this are the real world ramifications for this stuff that just sounds like, oh, it doesn't sound that important. No, it's just, money, economics. I can't wrap my head around it. This is what it is. It's death and destruction that is enabled by them leeching again off the productivity of real people, the average people that, you know, we are and that we interact with, and taking that momentum and using it to spread their empire for their own aggrandizement. And that is why it's fundamentally immoral at its base what is happening, but it is so abstracted and hided and hid behind all of these layers of you know, nice theoretical sounding economic buzzwords that most people never connect the two.
Yep. It's not many people. I had a friend back in the 90s who had a degree in political science, and he was interested in these kinds of subjects, and he would go to 7-Elevens, and he would bring a joke dollar that they used to print. They'd have $6 bills, and they'd have a picture of Bill Clinton on one side, Monica Lewinsky on the other side, and it was poorly printed on green pieces of paper, and you should be able to tell. He would pass them off. He'd walk in during lunchtime, and he'd give them to the clerk for a hot dog and a Slurpee, right? And the clerk would give them change. And the only problem they had is when they opened up the cash drawer, There was a place for the ones and the fives and the tens and the twenties and so on. There was no place for the $6 bills. So the clerk would lift the little black tray, slip it under there with the $100 bills and the checks, and that was the end of it. Well, it was kind of a cruel trick, but it illustrated something. The vast majority of people don't know anything about money other than how to count it. And that is an enormous disability. You have to understand money if you want to make it in this world, if you want to survive and you don't want to be impoverished. You must understand the concept. I got an article here from Technology News and Trends. And the headline is G20 Summit to Focus on Rising Anti-Globalization Sentiment. What do you think about that? Is there significant backlash against globalization right now, or is there just a little blip, little bump in the road, and globalization will continue unabated after the next election?
No, there is clearly, and I think obviously and undeniably at this point, a populist backlash against the status quo that we've seen certainly over the past few decades. And this is manifesting in the United States political context, obviously with Trump and with Sanders and with the fact that the most recent poll shows that Hillary has reached a new level of unfavorability rating, which officially makes these two candidates the most hated in the last 30 years, the most unfavorable candidates that have ever run against each other. So it's a question of who do you hate least at this point.
That's what it usually is. We don't vote for candidates. We vote against candidates. I'm going to vote for the Republican because I can't stand the Democrat. Right. And other people say, I'm voting for the Democrat. I'm going to hold my nose and vote for the Democrat because I can't stand the Republican.
Yes, but it's particularly pronounced this time where you have Republicans voting for Trump because they want to stick it to the Republican establishment, and you have Democrats that are revolting against the Democrat candidate. There's something that is changing right now, and I think it really is a populist reaction to the lies that have been sold, certainly since NAFTA and going on from that part about, these trade deals are going to be wonderful and it's going to benefit everyone. Well, the part of that that they tended to leave out, the asterisk that they never really filled in, was that, actually it's going to cause a lot of pain and squeeze a lot of people who are already suffering and on the lower end of the scale and people in manufacturing and other jobs like that. But, you know, overall, generally speaking, you know, a century from now, we'll be able to say generally that, you know, trade levels have made us a more prosperous society or something like that. Well, forgetting about the real human beings who are suffering in the meantime, and those real human beings are still voters and still people with voices, so obviously they're making themselves heard. Now, my bigger perspective on this is to say that the nationalist uprising that this is to a large extent about trade protection and things like that is not fundamentally, I think, going to be opposed to the overall creation of that global architecture that Brzezinski is talking about. It just means that the oligarchs have to be more skillful in couching it in populist terms. But I think, again, as I've said before, I don't think nationalism is really the antithesis to globalism. I think it's just a different stage of globalism. And once they get you rallying around a flag, all they have to do is get you to rally around a different flag at that point. And once you've subsumed your individual identity in some sort of collective, you're in the collectivist ideology. And then it's just a question of what stage. And nationalism is clearly a lesser stage of the globalist, you know, the fruition of that collectivist ideology. But it's still a stage on a rung on that ladder.
When we talk about nationalism, you don't see it as you don't see this as a fundamental force in itself, and I'm wondering if it's a consequence of the recession, depression, growing poverty. People are just, as long as people are making a buck and they're getting ahead, they don't care what the system is doing.
Yes, 100%. I can guarantee you, if this was the 90s all over. Yes, if this was the 90s all over again, and you know, things were looking great, 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 and people were making money, I guarantee you we would not be seeing the political type of ramifications that we are now. It is obviously, I think, quite obviously, that we've been living through this 8 years of recovery, which is obviously not a recovery. A lot of people have suffered and are suffering and see absolutely no bright spot. And they're being told every day through the media, everything's great, it's wonderful, look at unemployment. And people are living that disconnect. And so we're starting to see the political ramifications of that. But yes, you're right. When the economy is expanding, even if it's even if it's, you know, paper money that isn't fundamentally supported by anything, as long as people are feeling the effects of that, then they're going to be placated. But when it starts to pinch and it starts to really get them, that's when revolutions tend to happen.
Mm-hmm. Will the New World Order be able to weather this storm? Are they really threatened right now? Again, we talked about this a little earlier. Is it just a bump in the road, or is the New World Order really in trouble?
Well, look at it, again, from the overall picture of this. And here's a great specific way to look at it. Look at someone like Soros, who I'm sure the audience is more than familiar with and his various machinations. But again, people might not know. Recently, there was a hack of the Open Society Foundation, and 2,500 internal documents were spilled out via DCLeaks.com. And the documents showed, again, what most people already understood in various ways, but we have some more documentation on it now, the types of ways that that money is wielded for political influence around the world, and of course in the United States as well, where Soros has spent money donating to groups that literally paid for protesters to be bussed into Ferguson to start the protests that really were the impetus for the Black Lives Matter movement and this new stage of social unrest. At the same time, the Open Society Foundation is talking in some of these documents about their strategies for their justice initiative, I believe they call it, about the need for a more federalized police force. So you have the person who is creating the civil unrest by funding the groups that are literally bussing in the paid protesters to go and create civil unrest, at the same time arguing for more federal policing, and then of course Obama comes out and says we need a more federalized police force. Hello, they are creating the problem. They are creating the ready-made solution. They are playing the public like a fiddle as always. And the public, every time you punch this button, people are going to react this way. Here's the solution. And if it didn't work so well, they wouldn't be doing it anymore. But unfortunately, it still continues to work. So we have to understand, as long as they can create and channel the problems and create the discussion around you must be in on this side or this side of this debate, then they will get you into the logical matrix that will inevitably lead to their solutions.
When we talk about protesters being flown in, bussed in, whatever, to stir the hornet's nest and justify a federal police force, is it going to turn out that this new federal police force, will its primary targets be the protesters once it's established?
Of course. I mean, at a certain point, once the fans have been flamed enough, then you don't really need to continue paying people to be protesters or whatever. It will become a real movement because people really do become energetic and impassioned and start participating. Once that happens, you have genuine civil unrest, which is what I see forming right now in the United States context. And once that happens, and once that gets to a certain level, people are going to be crying out for police on the street or troops on the street.
Because the protesters
We need the National Guard. We need someone. Won't someone restore order? And I'm not even denigrating that response, because at a certain point when people really are rioting on the streets and things are becoming mayhem, well, you really do need some sort of solution to that. And the only way that people can think to resolve these problems is, well, I guess we got to have that federal police force, and people will be crying out for it. It's interesting to me because I started all of this 10 years ago with my website where we were in a context people were afraid of the Bush administration implementing martial law or something like that. But No, that's not how it works. Generally, by the time they implement something like that, people will be crying out for it.
I agree with you. We've got about 30 seconds left, and I guess that's just enough time for you to make a pitch for websites, blogs, podcasts.
I will just direct people to CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T report.com. If it's your first time there, just enjoy the archives. I have thousands of hours of media there completely free for browsing and perusal, and I hope it is an information resource. I always try to link to source documents and give people the sources that I'm working from so that you can come to your own conclusions. And if it is a valuable resource, if you do get information out of it, of course, I appreciate your support. You can subscribe to my newsletter there.
All right, James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. Thank you, James. Always a pleasure. Always interesting. Look forward to talking to you again in a couple of weeks. Thank you. Thank all of you folks for listening. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? Still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me.